Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a suicide car bomb in a formerly safe area of Iraq. What does it say about the power of ISIS?
But first, immigration attorneys are telling the Associated Press that they are already getting a flood of calls from people who are in the U.S. illegally to see if they will qualify for some legal status under President Obama's plan. And the president is going to announce that plan with an address to the nation tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern time, but it's expected to include executive actions that offer provisional legal status for up to 5 million out of about 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country. Republican leaders in Congress have expressed strong opposition to any executive action on immigration, saying by doing so, the president would be acting like a monarch. Enrique Acevedo is anchor and correspondent at Univision. He's with us from Washington. And Enrique, what are you expecting from the president tonight?
Well, let's have some perspective here. We've been dealing with this issue for more than three decades. The last time we had any major change on immigration policy was back when President Reagan was in power. So it's not an issue that's, you know, had to do with this administration. It's been there for the last three decades. It's been there for a long time. So we usually demand that our leaders, that our representatives act. And when they do, all hell breaks loose. So, you know, President Obama promised during the campaign he was going to try to pass immigration reform through Congress. He was able to do so in the Senate, and now that the House has enacted, it's the only reason why we don't have legislation on immigration at this point today. If they would bring that to a vote in the House, we would have comprehensive immigration reform, bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform, not something that the president would like, not something that activists would like, maybe not something that the GOP would like, but we would have legislation, and that's the bottom line. So I think with that perspective, you know, we have to understand why President Obama has decided to act unilaterally.
But do you think he's going to do enough to make many people who have been calling for action happy with what he does? We're talking about 4 to 5 million of the about 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country.
Well, it's not enough for the 12 million undocumented immigrants living in this country, but it's, I think, all that he can do by his own. He needs Congress to try to help, you know, the 7 million people who probably won't benefit from his decision tonight. But it's better than nothing. At least we'll have 5 million people who can benefit from this. 5 million people who are part of a larger group that contribute to this society. They pay their taxes. They're, in many ways, in the vast majority, model citizens, and they're here already. It's not like, you know, when we talk about immigration and immigration reform, it seems that there's a tone of people that, tone in people that think that something's going to happen once that we, you know, provide a legal framework for the life of 12 million people that are already here. They're already here. They've been here for decades. They've been contributing for decades. So it's not going to change a lot. We're just going to have, I guess, a more orderly and legal structure for what's going on in the country.
But there is the argument already being made by Republicans, and we hear it from Mitch McConnell, that if the president does what he is expected to do, that it is going to be unfair to people who have been going about things the legal way. Let's listen to what Mitch McConnell had to say.
What does the president have to say to the countless aspiring immigrants who've spent literally years waiting patiently in line? To the people who played by all the rules? Where is his compassion for them?
What about that, Enrique Acevedo?
Well, it's interesting that you asked me that question because I'm one of those people, Jeremy. I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but I'm in line. I have a green card. I came to this country with a visa. Then I got my green card. I waited in line for years. Now I'm waiting in line at least for 5 years to apply for my citizenship. And I tell you, this is very personal, of course, but I have no issue with people that have been here for decades, are able to also get in line and just, you know, come out of the shadows. And this is important also because if you ask, you know, the vast majority of undocumented immigrants in this country, they really don't care about how this goes about in terms of the political aspects of it. They just want to be left alone. They want to be able to work. They want to be able to come out of the shadows. I know it sounds like a cliche, but that's how they live. They live, you know, in constant fear of deportation. And they don't really, they're not looking for a document that says you're a citizen of this country. If they get that at the end, it's fine, but they're already a citizen, de facto citizens, because A paper doesn't make you part of this country or part of this nation. It does legally, but in a way, it's more than that. We're citizens or we're not citizens of a country, not because of a paper, but because of how we contribute to this nation.
Are you concerned, though, that if President Obama does this through executive action, that perhaps another president could come along with an executive action that these very people do not like, doing something in the reverse direction?
That's certainly a possibility, and it's not out of the question if we have a Republican president in 2016. I doubt that we'll have one if Republicans keep alienating Hispanics with dire warnings of what can happen if the president goes through with this executive action. I would love to see comprehensive immigration reform passed through Congress. That would be a permanent and real solution to the lives of these 12 million people who are already here. And, you know, we've talked about the arguments. It makes sense politically. It makes sense economically. It also makes sense from a humanitarian perspective. We have hundreds of American orphan children right now that have been separated from their parents because of deportations. So there have been 2 million people who have been deported during the last 6 years. Why don't we move forward this debate and understand that, you know, during the last 30 years, we haven't been able to solve this issue, and now the president is moving forward with something. Hopefully, from now until it's implemented, people will know that or Republicans can pass something in Congress.
Enrique Acevedo of Univision, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. Always a pleasure.
Well, yesterday saw the first major attack, presumably by ISIS supporters, in the capital of the Kurdish area of Iraq, Erbil. The suicide car bomb killed at least 6 people. Kurdish forces have been fighting to retake areas of northern Iraq that are now controlled by ISIS. But until now, Erbil has been untouched. Mitchell Prothero is Iraq bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He's in Erbil. And Mitchell, we say presumably ISIS fighters. Has anyone taken responsibility?
There's been a lot of chatter on what we would call credible but unofficial Islamic State Twitter and internet accounts taking credit for it. It's also just sort of an elimination of possibilities. I'm sure they're investigating exactly how or why it happened. And when I say they, I mean the Kurdish internal security forces. But I don't think there's much doubt in their minds, at least, where it originated from.
And how's that reverberating there?
You know, Erbil has a sense of safety to it that it's maintained even since the beginning of the U.S. invasion in 2003. Kurdistan, for the most part, didn't see virtually any of the ethnic violence that tore through the rest of Iraq. So this was always a very peaceful city, and it economically benefited from it to a huge degree. Businesses, starting even 2003 and 2004, you know, oftentimes moved up here as opposed to Baghdad to have a safe place to operate. The United Nations maintains virtually all of its Iraq presence now based out of Erbil. And so people are a little bit jumpy, but I would say that one of the things that has come to mind is people had expected incidents like this much sooner. The Islamic State's controlled Mosul just a few dozen miles away since mid-June. They are very fond of suicide bombings, would love to make the Kurdish government and the Iraqi government look weak. And from what I can tell, the security forces here break up, you know, attempts to do this sort of thing quite frequently. Mm-hmm. So there's been some inevitability to the sense of suicide bombs going off in Erbil, and maybe some credits due to the Peshmerga and the internal security forces that there have been more incidents like this so far.
That's interesting that it would be viewed that way, that this is reminding people that Peshmerga has been able to hold off ISIS fighters from Erbil. But catch us up on where the fight is. We remember the Kurdish fighters, the Peshmerga, hundreds traveled to Syria to fight ISIS there. They've also been fighting them in northern Iraq, trying to take back the land that ISIS has taken, and reportedly have launched a new offensive against ISIS about this bombing. But is there a way of saying who's winning, you know, the Peshmerga or ISIS?
Well, it depends on what your end goal is. At this stage, I would call it a stalemate. The Peshmerga have had to reorganize themselves and are very lightly equipped. They were not prepared to combat such an enemy. That's been improving. On the Islamic State side, they've suffered setbacks. There's been a few things that they've lost that they very much would like to have kept. The Rabia checkpoint, which controls the main highway between essentially Mosul and their capital in Syria of Raqqa, has fallen to the Peshmerga in the past couple of months. They would like that checkpoint back. And in August, they did manage to storm in and take over control of the Mosul Dam. And under heavy American bombardment, the government was able to retake that dam from them.
Yeah. Just briefly, how's the refugee situation in northern Iraq? We've spoken about this. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who've had to flee the homes that ISIS took control of. They've come to northern Iraq, come to Erbil. They don't have traditionally good relations, the Arab Iraqis with the Kurds. We've heard that the Kurds have been using the fight against ISIS to, in some cases, get rid of some of the Iraqi Arabs that they've had quarrels with. How's that working out?
In terms of the security forces and the Kurdish government, they are hosting hundreds of thousands of people who are traditionally their cultural and ethnic rivals in terms of Sunni Arabs from, you know, Baiji to Crete, Mosul. You know, so it's a little unfair on them to say that they've pushed people out when they've accepted, God, upwards of 500,000. And is there discrimination and harassment? There's a little bit, but honestly, less than I would have expected and less than I'd expect from, you know, somebody who's lived in the region for 12 years. This is not a kind place when you have to take refuge, you know, among strangers. And so for the most part, the Kurds have been better than I would have thought. But there are hundreds of thousands of people displaced in northern Iraq. Even in Erbil, one thing that there's a phenomenon this place was really building up over the years. They discovered oil. A lot of people were dumping investment into the area as Exxon, Mobil, Total, Marathon, all the major oil companies were sort of flooding in people. So they were building malls and luxury apartments, and all that stuff stopped in June. And so now there's construction sites all over the city that are literally crammed with homeless refugees. Huh. You know, what was supposed to be a five-star mall is filled with Christians from the town of Bartello, which was taken over by, you know, the Islamic State in August. And they're living in winter conditions. And northern Iraq is quite cold in winter. It goes down to freezing some nights, you know, trying to build temporary housing. So I'd say just about every free square meter of Kurdistan has a refugee in it at this stage. So it is putting some tension on there. I know the United Nations has been pouring resources in, but it's not enough. They've got a humanitarian crisis here that's almost so vast you get used to it.
Mitchell Prothero, Iraq Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers in Erbil in northern Iraq. Mitchell, thank you.
No problem. It's always my pleasure.
Taylor Swift's song Blank Space, it's number one on the Billboard Hot 100 right now. She's the first woman in history to dethrone herself, because before that, her song Shake It Off was on top. But what makes a song shoot to number one is changing in the digital age. Derek Thompson writes about this in The Atlantic. He's with us now. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And people used to think about commercial radio executives deciding that a song had what it takes to be popular. You write that now that seems to be changing and things are being driven really from the bottom up.
It's true. This is the most populist moment in music history. And in the old days, 1950s, 60s, music was an aristocracy. You had hit men at record labels on the coast essentially deciding what songs would be hits and then often paying radio stations to play those songs a lot. And so the songs, the hits were coming from the top. Now they're coming from the bottom. And the reason why is that it's so easy now to see what people are actually listening to. When we hear a song on Shazam, on YouTube, we're creating a relationship with music that can be searched and viewed and collected and studied by analytics companies and the record labels. And so when we hear hits on the radio and see hits on the charts, these hits are democratically sourced. It is the most populist moment in music history.
And when you say Shazam, by the way, for people who don't know, this is an app that many people have on their phones at this point, and you can hold it up to a speaker or maybe even in a crowded restaurant or bar. It'll listen to the song just for a few seconds and almost always can figure out what song it is. So you're saying that this app, Shazam, has changed the music industry.
It has. We think of Shazam as a relationship between us, the listeners, and the song. It's like a Google search for a song. But the same way that analytics companies can look at Google searches all over the world to see what people are concerned about, these analytics companies and record labels can look at Shazam data to see what's the most popular song now in Houston, in Brooklyn, in Hyderabad, India. And so what they're doing is they can debut a song online or play a song on a small radio station and see in real time how curious people are to know more about that song by looking at Shazam data.
And we have an example, and I want to play a song here. This is something that seemed to come out of the blue and rise right up the top of the charts. Let's listen. And we'll never be royal. That is, of course, Royals by Lorde, and you say Shazam actually predicted that that song would rise to the top.
Because Shazam essentially can see a map of global music curiosity, they can literally follow the interest in a song like Royals, starting in New Zealand, hopping over the strait to Sydney, moving on to the coast of the United States, popping up in Nashville. And this is really useful for music labels, but also for people just interested in the spread of information to see how does a contagion event really spread around the world. Shazam can answer that question for us.
So how is this data being used by record executives and radio stations? It seems that there's a lot of money at stake here if people can figure out how to use this in the right way.
Right. So I went to Republic Records and I talked to a scout there and had him show me how a scout literally uses Shazam in the real world. And here's what they do. You debut a song, a new single in a radio station, let's say in Houston. And what you can do is to check Shazam searches in nearby cities to see if people are searching for that song a lot. And if they are searching for that song more than the typical song, you can take that to other marketers and say, we know from organic curiosity data on Shazam that people, when they hear this song, they're leaning forward and they want to hear it again. And so what you can see is that our very organic and honest relationship to music is trickling up. And it's influencing the way that radio playlists are built and the Billboard Hot 100 is arranged.
So, sounds great, democratization of music and all of that. But many people are looking at this and saying, everything's becoming too bland. It's becoming too alike. We only want to hear music that sounds like the music that we already know. I want to listen here to a montage of some of the songs that have hit the top of the Billboard Hot 100 in the last year and a half. Let's listen. So there we have John Legend's All of Me. We had Miley Cyrus's Wrecking Ball, Timber's Pitbull, Dark Horse by Katy Perry, and Fancy by Iggy Azalea. Derek, there is a similarity there to some of those songs.
Perhaps. You know, what I found when I talked to musicologists and people who really study the characteristics of pop music, they said that what's happening is that as music is becoming more democratic, it's also arguably becoming more derivative. It's certainly becoming more repetitious, more static, and less varied. So to go through those quickly, more repetitious. Radio now has played the same songs over and over again as it's learned that that's all we want to do when we tune into Top 40. Blurred Lines, the number one song of last year, played 70% more than the top song from a decade earlier. More static. Once a song hits the Billboard Hot 100, it just stays there. It reflects the fact that we're just listening to the same songs again and again, so a hit enters the top 10, it just stays there. And finally, less varied. There was a study from a Spanish university that looked at the chord progressions of the most popular songs in the world. They found that the diversity of chord progressions was falling by the decade, and particular in the last 20 years. So again, more repetitious, more static, and less varied.
Although I remember a radio station, I won't name any names, but it was a soft rock station that their motto was songs you know by artists you've heard of, which is apparently what many people want. So what does this mean for indie artists or people who aren't going to be the catchiest tune that gets picked up and Shazammed by everybody in America?
I think it's fair to point out that this is a wonderful time to be a fan of music because it's so easy to find stuff on YouTube, Spotify, Pandora. But here's the thing for that indie band. It's easier than ever to get your music listened to because you can upload it to the internet. But because it's so easy to do this, lots of bands are doing this. So you have more music than ever. A lot of it's incredibly experimental and interesting and extremely varied. But because it turns out that the vast majority of people just want to hear the same songs, you need a lucky break. You need to be on a commercial that millions of people see or on an American Idol episode that millions of people are watching in order to enter that power rotation of familiarity that really separates the gigantic hits from the vast majority of music.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and we'll link you to his article all about this at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
NBA player Jason Collins made headlines last spring when he came out as the first openly gay player in the NBA. Last night at the Brooklyn Nets game, that's Jason's former team, he made another announcement. He is retiring after 15 years in the NBA. Jason Collins joins us now from New York. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me on.
Well, why are you retiring now?
I've been thinking about this since the summer. My body's been talking to me for a while. As all professional athletes know, Father Time is undefeated. And when I wake up in the morning, my back especially is letting me know that it's about time to bow out gracefully and let the young guys take it and just, you know, move to, you know, being a full-time fan of the sport.
And this is, of course, happening about 18 months after you made history and becoming the first openly gay player in the NBA. How do you think that went?
Oh, I think it went great as far as my interaction with my teammates, with my opponents, with the fans, with the media. I think it showed that it's okay. I was able to go out there and do my job, help make plays to help my team win. And then when the game is over, my boyfriend would be in the family room just like everyone else's loved ones are. And I didn't have to hide anything.
Do you wish that you had done it earlier in your career?
Yeah, looking back on it, yes. But again, I wasn't ready earlier in my career. I spent a large part of my life in a state of denial. And it took me a long time to get to that point of acceptance and fully embrace and be proud of all that makes me unique and all that makes me who I am.
Did you have any negative experiences with anybody after you came out?
I've had one. All the fans were incredible, were supportive. There's always going to be that one person who says something, expresses his opinion to me, but that was one knucklehead. That was one instance, and everyone else throughout the NBA has been incredible. So you do have that, but it all goes back for me to a great conversation that I had with Judy Shepherd, Matthew Shepherd's mom, where she said to me, you know, Jason, just keep living your life. And let the haters hate.
Well, you've said that you think that there are other professional athletes in the NFL, the NHL, the MLB that you know personally who are gay. Do you think that we're likely to see more people now follow your lead and come out publicly and continue to play major league sports?
I hope so. Again, I would never out anyone, but, you know, I hope that they can see from my example from Robbie Rogers, the Los Angeles Galaxy soccer player's example. When it comes to male athletes playing and being able to go out there and do your job and, you know, be able to live your authentic life at the same time, I would hope that they find that courage. And again, I know that that can be a long path, that some of them are still working through certain issues, but I hope that they find that strength to, you know, formally make that announcement and then continue to go on with their career, regardless of if they're in sports. But Tim Cook recently coming out is incredible and talking about, you know, we're all, you know, brick by brick adding to the path of justice. And I did my part and will continue to do my part, continue to speak up and speak out for those that remain voiceless. But we're all in this together.
Jason Collins, the first openly gay NBA player, and he is retiring from basketball about 18 months after coming out publicly as gay. Jason Collins, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Today is a day of protest across Mexico, and people in the U.S. and around the world are marching as well in solidarity. At the heart of it, the disappearance and presumed murder of those 43 university students who were allegedly shot at by police, who then reportedly handed them over to a criminal gang. Authorities have arrested and accused a local mayor of being the mastermind, and remains were found. The attorney general gave gruesome descriptions of what happened. But his account is suspect to people who wonder why the government didn't do more sooner. Compounding all of this, recent revelations that the president and first lady of Mexico bought a multi-million dollar mansion, which is still in the name of a company that had been awarded lucrative public contracts, further evidence to protesters of countrywide government corruption. The rallying cry now across Mexico, ya me cansé, I've had enough. Francisco Goldman is a journalist and writer. He's with us by Skype from Mexico City. Francisco, welcome.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
That rallying cry, it's really absolutely translated as I'm finally tired, or, you know, I've had enough. It comes from the attorney general, who spoke and gave a pretty gruesome press conference announcing that they'd found what they believed to be the charred remains of the students and that they had video testimony from these gang members. How did that reverberate? How did that press conference reverberate in the country?
I think it was almost a transformative moment for Mexico, because it was such a, the country had been waiting almost with bated breath for some sort of news of the students. There were all kinds of, you know, they were going around turning up, you know, grave after grave after grave full of people, and they weren't the students. The parents were furious because they were saying, why are you looking in graves? Our kids are still alive, which was really, you know, heartbreaking. And suddenly they hold this press conference. He claimed that they had finally found three witnesses from the gang, Guerreros Unidos, who had taken part in the murder of the students. And this is, he's telling all of this in like really terrible detail.
It is unimaginable that the family members, some of whom had asked that these details not be given, but that this the country is listening to the details of how these students were killed, some burned alive, just horror. And yet, we know Mexico's recent history. We know about brutal, brutal massacres of people, corruption. Why do you think this has been so transformative?
I think it's been building for a long time, right? From the start of the narco war under Calderón, Mexicans have felt really, truly abandoned by the federal authorities, unprotected. They've been having their children and families murdered, disappeared. They're living in towns where people are terrified to go out at night. Just really, really bearing the brunt of this war, so-called war, without any justice, seeing, you know, with complete impunity reigning over the country. They all know that organized crime, you know, has penetrated politics locally and nationally, and they see no sign of any effort being made to bring anybody to justice. This crime happens, it coalesces that anger for a lot of reasons, partly because it's 43 students, right? We've had some massive massacres here, like the 73 Central American migrants, for example, that were found in Tamaulipas. But the Mexicans could be made to think of those people as others, right? The 43 students, they really were Mexico's own. Everybody knows what those students are like. Also, this because the lines of connection in this particular case between local authorities and top elite politicians were so clear. It was almost like a diagram of how corruption and impunity work in the country.
Do you think there's any possibility of change?
Yes, I do, because Mexico's done it before. We have elections here. As corrupt as the democracy can be, you can actually force change through the ballot box if you organize well enough. They have 4 years to do it. I think the traditional political parties are very discredited right now. I think you have the Mexican left has been very lively but very fragmented. And they're just going to have to come together. And this is a real opportunity for Mexico to find a way to kind of reinvent its democracy. Father Solalinde told me he thinks that the new political leaders, whoever they turn out to be, are going to come from outside the political system. But what you have here is just unbelievable effervescence happening. It's also getting very dangerous. And this is really important. Yesterday, especially, the day before yesterday, you could see that the language coming from the PRI and their supporters was getting very menacing. It's the governing party, right? And of course, they're responsible. The most tragic human rights crime, maybe, and one that has changed Mexico forever, was the 1968 student massacres. And yesterday, President Peña Nieto made some comments claiming that it seemed to be part of this effort to criminalize the protests, claiming that he thought that a lot of the protests actually were designed to sort of be subversive of Mexico.
So what is the feeling there now? You've got the president yesterday making what seemed like threats against protesters, but you've got people outraged. And you've got the drug cartels, by the way, watching on the sideline. They don't want change. They're certainly not supporting the protests. So what's the mood there?
The mood is today tense and excited. Here in Mexico City, three caravans that went out from Guerrero are arriving, converging in the city, and it's going to be a massive day of protests here. They start at 4:30, three different meeting points. I believe, supposedly, that students were going to try to surround the airport, and it's going to be tense because we don't know, all these threats have been being made the last couple of days. We don't really know what that means. There's a chance that there's going to be violence because at every march, these small groups of so-called anarchists turn up who seem intentionally bent on provoking violence. A lot of people say that at least some of them are infiltrators who are there to intentionally give police, if they want, a justification for attacking students.
Some say they're backed by the police.
Yes, exactly. So that's going to happen. They're going to be there, right? So So it's going to be an interesting day. I'd look at your newspaper tomorrow morning or your digital site later tonight or on Twitter, hashtag Yamacanse. You'll find all kinds of news.
Well, Francisco Goldman, best to you. He's there in Mexico City. He's a reporter, writer. His latest book is The Interior Circuit, a Mexico City Chronicle. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
We're remembering one of the most honored and successful figures in entertainment today, Mike Nichols, who died last night. He directed The Odd Couple on Broadway, The Graduate on film, Angels in America on TV. He was 83 years old and once said his life as the ultimate showbiz insider came from lessons learned while growing up an outsider. NPR's Eric Deggans explains.
Mike Nichols pulled unforgettable, landmark performances from some of Hollywood's most accomplished actors. In 1966, he delivered Elizabeth Taylor as a sharp-tongued wife tearing into husband Richard Burton in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great, big, fat
stop it, Mother.
By 1986, he showcased Meryl Streep slowly unraveling as she talked about her philandering husband in Heartburn.
You sort of notice that things are not the way they were, but it's a distant bell. And then when things do turn out to have been wrong, it's not that you knew all along. It was just that you were somewhere else.
And Nichols' most famous scene.
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me.
That's Dustin Hoffman in his breakout role, playing a bewildered 20-something about to begin an unwise affair with an older, married woman in 1967's The Graduate. Nichols was a master at pushing talents like Hoffman and Streep to unexpected places. Their confused characters often highlighted thorny issues in modern life. In The Graduate, Hoffman became a symbol of baby boomers' uncertainty in a changing world, suffering through useless advice from clueless elders.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word. Plastics.
Exactly how do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it.
But Nichols shrugged off credit for leading actors to great performances in this 1990 interview for the Museum of the Moving Image.
You can't direct actors very much in a movie. Because if you tell them what to do, they'll be doing what you told them. What's interesting in a movie is something happening that nobody planned.
Nichols understood American culture as only someone born outside the U.S. really could. He was born Michael Igor Peshkowski in Germany, the son of a Russian Jew. He fled the Nazis in 1939 at age 7, and his physician father died a few years later, leaving a wife and 2 sons to struggle in New York City.
The thing about being an outsider no matter what is that there's a good part, which is that it teaches you to hear what people are thinking.
In 2012, Nichols told NPR his early isolation brought a lifelong advantage.
Because I learned to hear what people are thinking, quite literally, I think it stood me in good stead. It's probably why I'm in the theater, because I can hear an audience. I could hear an audience thinking when I was in front of them.
That skill at reading audiences was crucial when he turned from medical studies to theater in college. By the late 1950s, he had teamed with actress-writer Elaine May to create the improvisational comedy duo Nichols and May. They were all over the TV shows of the day, including the Jack Paar Show.
Yes, I read your ad. I'm interested in the $65 funeral.
Was that for yourself?
No.
But performing lost its luster for Nichols, so in 1963, he agreed to direct a play by a TV joke writer. Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park became a blockbuster success, and suddenly, as Nichols told NPR, he realized directing was the job he was really meant to do.
To my surprise, where I never quite got how I was going to be an actor, because I don't think I'm suited to be an actor, I immediately realized that all this time I thought I was thinking about acting, I was really thinking about directing.
You could spend a long afternoon listing all the classic stage, film, and TV projects that Nichols touched as a director or producer. The Odd Couple, Plaza Suite, Hurley Burley, and Spamalot on Broadway. Movies like Carnal Knowledge, Silkwood, Working Girl, and Primary Colors, along with versions of Wit and Angels in America for HBO on TV. At times, Nichols could seem like a showbiz version of Zelig. He co-produced Broadway's original 1977 version of the hit musical Annie and gave Whoopi Goldberg a career in the mid-80s when he brought her one-woman show to Broadway. So it makes sense Nichols would be one of only 12 artists to become what industry types call an EGOT, someone who's won Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Awards. But when Nichols talked about why he loved directing with NPR, grand honors weren't a big part of the equation.
It's a wonderful job. It's exploring and excavating and analyzing all at once. And plays, especially great plays, yield their secrets over a long period of time. And that's the great excitement.
Despite passion for his work and loads of success, Nichols said it took his 4th wife, ABC News anchor Diane Sawyer, to rescue him from depression in his mid-50s. By 2012, he said his production of Death of a Salesman, which won him his 6th Tony Award, might be his last play. But a year later, he was back on Broadway, leading a revival of Harold Pinter's Betrayal. He'd worked on adapting a version of the Tony-winning play Masterclass for HBO this year with Meryl Streep before his death. He couldn't stay away, his passion for the stage still driving him after more than 5 decades. Eric Deggans, NPR News.
Well, people who knew Mike Nichols are paying tribute. Steven Spielberg says he was one of America's all-time greatest film and stage directors, his death a seismic loss. On ABC's The View, Whoopi Goldberg broke down in tears. She couldn't speak about the man she called her mentor. He shot her to fame in 1984 when he brought her monologue Whoopi to Broadway. So if she couldn't speak, she played an interview she did with Nichols last year in which he remembered meeting her for the first time.
You opened the door, and I burst into tears, and we fell into each other's arms. This is very unusual.
And this is why I love Mike, because he'll say, we'll rehearse, then we're going to have some lunch with Carl and Paul and Steve. Now, I have friends named Carl, Paul, and Steve, too, you know, so I thought, oh, okay. We walk into the restaurant, it's Carl Reiner, Paul Simon, and Steve Martin. And all I could do was sit there and kind of go, because I didn't know what to do.
And actress Andrea Martin is tweeting today, Nichols and May, where improv was born. Genius. Well, Eric mentioned that combination. Mike Nichols and Elaine May, they were hugely popular. They won Grammys for skits like these. See if you can hear a direct line to Garrison Keillor and his skits with a fictional mom.
Hello.
Hello, Arthur. This is your mother. Do you remember me?
Mom, I was just going to call you. Is that a funny thing? You know that I had my hand on the phone.
You were supposed to call me last Friday.
Well, honey, I know. I just didn't have a second, and I could cut my throat.
I sat by that phone all day Friday.
Honey, I was working.
Day Friday night.
Darling, I was in the lab.
All day Sunday.
Mom.
And your father finally said to me, Phyllis, eat something. You'll faint. I said, no, Harry, no. I don't want my mouth to be full when my son calls it.
And we have a Nichols favorite, Robin Williams, as the director of a drag queen cabaret in the Mike Nichols-directed The Birdcage, coaching a truculent dancer played by Hank Azaria.
What about me? What do? Do I just stand here like an object?
No. You do an eclectic celebration of the dance. You do Fosse, Fosse, Fosse. You do Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham. Or Twyla, Twyla, Twyla. Or Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd. Or Madonna, Madonna, Madonna. But you keep it all inside.
And we have to mention the Monty Python musical Spamalot, directed by Mike Nichols on Broadway.
And always look on the bright side of life.
Our thoughts today are with Mike Nichols' wife, Diane Sawyer. Jeremy, rumor had it that he lit her while she was on the new set, Lucky Woman, but she, as we heard, lit up his life. Mike Nichols was 83. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.